That was awesome this morning. And Shane Willard is exactly that. He's a great friend to our house. He was here last year around about Easter time, and people rave. They rave about, he's only here one night. I'm here every weekend. Every weekend, one night, one message, and people could tell you exactly what he preached. Like, a kid's coming up to me, is Pastor Shane, can I talk about the war horse again? And I said, probably not. Do you remember what Pastor Tony spoke last weekend, love? No. Pastor Shane's a great friend of our house. He is an amazing teacher of the Bible and just makes it come alive, makes it so real, so significant, and so powerful. I know you're going to be tremendously blessed today. I'm going to ask you to stand on your feet right now. I'm going to ask you to give him a big Impact Church welcome as he comes to stage today. God bless you, Shane.
That's amazing. Go on, man. Thank you very much. Thank you. You can be seated. If you're the type that likes to follow along in an actual Bible, Ezekiel chapter 18, I want to talk to you about Father's Day, because that's appropriate. I want to talk to you about what it means to honor your father. I want to talk to you about empowering your life by taking responsibility. I want to connect all those dots for us. If this is first time you've ever met me, this is all I do for a living. I travel around and speak. Had the incredible privilege of being mentored by a pastor who just happens to have his rabbi training as well. So all my stuff comes from that bent. Also have a master's degree in clinical psychology. So I'm qualified to sort your head out. So be careful what you say to me, because I can see through all that stuff. On your way out, right there to the left, there's a gigantic resource table. If you walk out there and have trouble finding my resource table, I need you to call a doctor, because it's taken up half the foyer. If you look at that and you go, why would you carry all that around with you? The reason is, wait for it, we make a lot of money from it, all right? And the reason, I mean a lot of money. And the reason we do that is because we believe that we're not simply called to go to heaven when we die, but we're called to partner with Jesus to bring heaven to every place we see hell here. And so 100% of what we make out there is what we use to do justice in the world. So we support three orphanages in China that look after mentally handicapped kids, two in Hanyang, one in Changsha. We also have a rescue home in Cape Town that gets women out of sex trafficking. Just to give you a testimony about that table. This was a few months ago. I was asked for the first time to come to this gigantic church, and I got there, and we moved so much at that table that we were able to meet all of our commitments for that month to our orphanages and stuff, as well as to give $5,000 extra to another church that was partnering together to build a proper shelter for a leper colony in India. And so we don't want to just simply go to heaven when we die. We honor that and we believe that. But if all we're doing is sitting on our butt waiting to go to heaven when we die, that's boring. Okay, that's boring. Unless you're 107. If you're 107, you can wait to go to heaven when you die, because it's coming quickly. It's right there. But if you're not 107, what that means is that you woke up today with infinite possibilities that partnering with the risen Christ has for us to make our world a better place. And so all I'm saying is before you go to your Father's Day cookout, or eat, or whatever, if you could come by and let me put something in your hands that'll change the way you look at God. And in so doing, you'll put something in our hands that helps us feed, clothe, shelter, and educate mentally handicapped kids in China. I think that's a pretty good trade. Everything's available in four formats: CD, DVD, USB, and direct download. Okay? If you don't know what a USB is, just buy the CD, all right? Or bring your nine-year-old with you, and they will show you what to do with a USB. All right. So I want to talk to you about empowering your life by taking responsibility. I want to talk to you about honoring your father. I want to do this by looking at an ancient text. This ancient text is several thousand years old, and it was written by a guy named Ezekiel, and it was meant to challenge and encourage slaves in Babylon. So essentially, there were these Jewish people who were taken slaves in Babylon, and Ezekiel is given this mission from the Lord to encourage and challenge them to keep going and to change their life. Now, because it's several thousand years old, he's going to use words that don't mean the same thing today, right? So you can't superimpose 2017 white people definitions over the top of ancient Jewish thought. So when he uses certain words, we got to be sure that we interpret it how he intended it to his original audience, or we run the risk of saying something scary. And I'm not so concerned. If you've been a church person your whole life, I'm not worried about you. What I'm worried about is someone who's giving church a first try today. And if I don't explain these words, it could sound flippin' terrifying what he's saying. But it's not. It's more of a challenge. So let me introduce the terminology to us first, and then we're going to read the passage. If you guys could bring that slide up for me. All right, so the introduction to terminology first is life, light, and increase. Now these, in Ezekiel's world, they were descriptions of a way of life that led to abundance and peace, and it's tied to a choice. It's not literal light, like turn the light on, and it's not literal life, like to breathe air. It was a metaphor about living in God's best. It's life, light, and in the Bible, it's presented as choices. Choose life, not death. Choose light, light, dark. Obviously metaphors. No one chooses when they're born or when they die. But in this sense, in the metaphorical sense, it's choose to be a person of life, not death. Choose to be a person of light, not dark. Now, conversely, the other side of that is true as well. Next slide. This is the second way to do it. This is death, darkness, and decrease. Now, these are descriptions of a way of life that leads to disrepair or unraveling of completion. It's a choice to live outside of God's ways. There's going to be certain sentences in this passage where he says, if you choose to sin, you will die. And if you take that literally, like, every time I mess up, I could die, that's terrifying. Or worse, if you read it as someone who sins goes to hell, that's even worse and even more terrifying and not true, okay? That's the bigger deal, right? It's the soul that sins, the soul that sins will die. In this sense is, when you choose to live outside of God's ways, your life goes into disrepair, unraveling of completion, death, not life, dark, not light. These were choices. Now, with that as the backdrop, let's read this passage. This is Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 1. He's writing to slaves in Babylon. Here's what he says. And the word of the Lord came to me saying, what do you people mean by quoting this proverb about the land of Israel? The father ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, you will no longer quote this proverb in Israel. Now, let's stop right there and talk about this. First, what is that proverb? The father eats sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. First, what is it? Second, why is God so ticked off about it? He doesn't want to ever hear it again. Now, to understand this, we have to understand a quick history of Israel. So, I need you to sit up and pay attention because here is the entire history of Israel in 90 seconds. Ready? Here we go. There was a guy named Abraham who had a kid named Isaac who had a kid named Jacob who had 12 kids. Those 12 kids end up in Egypt because of famine and are given land. And then they started having babies. And those people had babies. And then those people had babies. And then the babies had more babies. And there was more babies. And there was more babies. And then babies upon babies upon babies upon babies until the population of that family started to outgrow Egypt. This threatened the Egyptian king, a guy named Pharaoh, and he did the only natural thing he knew to do, which was to enslave this family who had become very large. Years later, God raises up a man named Moses to get them out of slavery into freedom. He gives them their own land and he says, I want you to be a nation that maintains justice and righteousness to the poor. Because remember, I am a slave liberator. So, they gives them a mission to maintain justice and righteousness to the poor. This frankly turns out terrible. By their third king, a guy named Solomon, this is what the book of Kings says. It says that Solomon collected horses and chariots and spears and sold them for a profit between nations. In short, he was an arms dealer. Secondly, it says that this is the account of the slave labor that Solomon forced to build the temple of the Lord. So, a guy who comes from a lineage of freed slaves is now forcing slaves to build the temple to honor the Lord who frees the slaves. And he failed to see the irony in that. God said, no. And this group of people ends up back in slavery in a place called Babylon. Who do they blame for their slavery? They blame Solomon. Solomon abandoned his mission from the Lord. It's so much so that they wipe his name out of the historical record for hundreds of years. They refuse to even say his name. They just call him David's son. It's David's son's fault. David's son failed, and that's why we are where we are. Which is why the prophets writing to the Babylonian slaves, they say things like this. Take heart. For God will bring a new son of David who will maintain justice and righteousness to the poor. Yes, the first son of David failed, but the next son of David will not. Fast forward to Jesus. People call Jesus a lot of things. Jesus, son of David. Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus, son of Joseph. Jesus Christ. But the poor and the afflicted, what do they call him? Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. In other words, are you the one the prophet spoke about? Are you the new son of David who's supposed to maintain justice and righteousness to the poor? Because if you are, newsflash, I'm poor, which means you're here for me. Now, back to the slaves in Babylon. I thought that was pretty good, by the way. Thank you. At first, you seemed unimpressed. And I was like, well, here we go. So all slave cultures everywhere, in order to cope, they write songs, poems, plays. Why? Because you can't make suffering an intellectual exercise. It's not an intellectual exercise. You can't explain great suffering in bullet points. You can explain it with songs, plays, poems. So if you go read the books of Psalms, all these poems, a lot of those Psalms came out of the slave culture. Especially if you're ever reading a Psalm and it says, the Lord our God's going to bless the person who bashes someone's head against a stone. That's not God talking. That's a slave talking about what he hopes God does to the slave driver. Okay. This is how you cope. Some of the greatest, music in American spirituals are the African American spirituals. Oppressive literature written in poem form. And so they did the same thing. And one of the things they made up to cope was a proverb. They actually made it into a song that then became a proverb. And it said this, my father ate sour grapes and it set my teeth on edge, which is an odd sort of backwards analogy to say somebody else did something wrong and I'm the one suffering for it, right? And this got going. Now, I need you to come back here to me, because if you found the last 4 minutes boring or didn't know where I was going with that, let me explain the entire thing in one statement. Here's what's going on in this passage. Ready? The current generation is blaming the previous generation for why they are the way they are. Well, that's not relevant at all, is it? We've never heard that before. Oh, I'm a pastor and a counselor, and I'm looking at a front row full of pastors and counselors. Occasionally, we have to confront people on their behavior. And the number of times it goes like this, sir, your behavior is unacceptable. You can't act like that. It'll destroy everything that's important to you. And the guy goes, I know, but if you just knew what my dad was like, you would understand why I am the way I am. Or, ma'am, your behavior is unacceptable. Nobody can put up with you. You're critical, cantankerous, and horrible. And I don't want to be the one to break this to you, but your husband's secretly praying for a comet to come to earth to bring him sweet relief from you. And the woman says, I know, but my mom was critical, cantankerous, and horrible, so I'm critical, cantankerous, and horrible. We hear this all the time. It goes like this. My dad was drunk and isolated, so I'll be drunk and isolated. My dad was a glutton and struggled with food, so I'll be a lazy glutton and struggle with food. My mom was abusive, critical, and horrible, so I'll be abusive, critical, and horrible. My dad was a drunk, I'll be a drunk. My dad was horrible with money, I'll be horrible with money. And here's the problem with that. You're 40. Look, I'm a trained counselor. If you answer me honestly in about 30 minutes, I can tell you why you are the way you are. Ray Charles can see why you are the way you are. Yep. Yep, you're right. Your mom was critical, cantankerous, and horrible. I get it. Yep. Your dad was abusive and drunk. I get it. But you're 40. At what point are you going to stand on your own two feet and go, I am not bound to be like that and ruin my life and my children's life as well. I can make a different choice. Look, if you're 8, which I see the children stayed in here today, so I'm going to have to change a few jokes I was going to tell. If you're 8, you can blame your parents for why you are the way you are. But if you're not 8, it's you. If you're an adult, it's you. You say, Shane, you don't understand. You don't understand, man. My family had issues. Really? Let me ask you a question. Did your family have a man and a woman trying to live together? It's going to be issues. Look, even if you marry well, like, marriage is just flipping difficult. It's fragile. It's tensionous. It's beautiful. It's meaningful. It's horrible. It's everything. It's not dichotomous. It's the tension of strength in between. Heck, the Bible can't even agree on marriage. Solomon said, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. Paul says, he who marries does not sin, but he signed up for a life of pain. What's the Bible say about marriage? Depends on who you read. Solomon, marriage, let's do it. A lot. Paul's like, make it your last choice on earth. Why? Marriage is hard. Even if two people are basically good-hearted and basically mentally healthy, marriage is just flipping difficult. Why? Because of preferences. Most things in marriage aren't about right or wrong. It's about preference. And women prefer different things than men. Even simple things like smells. Women prefer sweet smelling things. Perfume, flowers, candles. You give a woman a bouquet of flowers, she's going to sniff it 100 times out of 100. You hand a man a bouquet of flowers, all he smells is $70. That's what it costs. Women love sweet smelling stuff. You go to a big enough mall, you can find two women in a candle shop sniffing wax for an hour and calling that fun. That's just, frankly, weird. You'll never see two men doing that. Never. Ever. You imagine going to a mall and seeing two men sniffing wax? That'd be so weird. Hey, Billy, check that out, man. That's that new white lilac scent, man. That is something special. That is something special. Of course, that candle shop's in Alabama, but nonetheless. Why don't you see men doing that? Because men, in their DNA, prefer stinky things. Nothing funnier to a group of men than when something stinky happens. That's hilarious. Women find that disgusting. But men love it. And it's not just that. It's everything stinky. Like if men are playing rugby, and they put their dirty, sweaty, nasty clothes after they're done in a plastic bag, tie it up and throw it in the boot of the car. 3 months later, they're looking at the boot of the car for something. And they find that plastic bag. Every man in this room knows what must happen. It's in our DNA. It's not even a choice. We have to open that bag and we 100% have to sniff it. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Here's the thing. Even if you could train a man to put his dirty clothes in the dirty clothes hamper, right? If you watch him, when he takes his clothes off, throws them in the dirty clothes hamper, he normally ends with his socks. He'll take his socks off that he wore at work all day, and just before he drops it in the hamper, he will do this. It's like we prove we work or something. And I can promise you, if it doesn't stink bad enough, he'll be like, you know what? I can get one more wear out of these. I can tell you right now. I can do that. Why? Because we like stinky things. Of course we do. If I open that bag with the rugby clothes in it, the thing is, it's not just me. If I have three friends standing there, they have to smell my stinky thing. It's called a courtesy sniff, if you're wondering. It's a code of the man. I've found something stinky. Everybody's got to sniff it. The problem is that if they sniff my stinky thing, then if they ever have a stinky thing, I have to sniff their stinky thing. It's courtesy sniffing, which is why if you're ever caught in traffic in Brisbane and there's four guys in one car and three of them have their head out the window and the fourth guy's in the back seat laughing, he just cashed in on his courtesy sniff. Your family had issues? Of course they did. Men and women prefer different things. You say, Shane, you understand, my dad had issues. Really? Of course your dad had issues. Everybody's dad has issues. He's a human being. My dad's a great guy. Really good man. I can tell you that it is 8 o'clock at night on Saturday night in America. This morning at 4:30 in the morning, he would have been up praying for this meeting. I don't have to ask. He didn't text me. I just know he did. The reason I know he did is because he's been doing it every day of my entire life. My dad has been up praying for me early before I got up every day my whole life. It's been getting progressively earlier too. When I was a kid, it was 6. When I went to junior high, it was 5:30. High school was 5. I went to university, it was 4:30. Now he gets up at 4:15 to start praying at 4:30. I was talking to him the other day and he said, son, I'm thinking about getting up earlier. I said, dad, if you live 10 more years, you're going to have deep breakfast the night before. This is getting ridiculous. My dad's a great guy. Up every day. My dad had issues. Namely, he liked to scare us. And I'm not talking about a small fright neither. I'm talking about flipping terrifying somebody. I've never been a morning person my whole life. I've always liked to stay up late and then sleep in. And so my mom would come in and wake me up in the morning. She'd shake me awake and then sit me up on the side of the bed. I want to be clear about this. I was 6, okay? I think the boogeyman lives under the bed anyway. So my mom would sit me up on the side of the bed and then I'd fall back asleep. My father decided that's enough of that, and he decided to break me of that. The way he decided to break me of that was to hide under my bed. Of course, he didn't tell Mom about this. She wouldn't have allowed it. But Mom comes in and shakes me awake, sits me up on the side of the bed. And just as I was about to fall back asleep, my father reached out and grabbed my feet. Your dad had issues? My dad also liked to embarrass us. He thought it was hilarious. There's one time he was dropping me off for junior high Bible camp, which is something that happens in America. It's a pretty big thing. Anyway, 114, 13-year-old. What could go wrong? Anyway, dad pulls up at the church. You picture the big, huge school buses that you see on TV from America. Humongous things. Two full buses full of us. Dad pulls up. Here's what he says to me. He says, son, I love you. First, I said, good. He said, second, I believe in you. I'm proud of you. I said, thanks, dad. He said, third, I'm going to pray for you every single day that God's going to touch your life at camp. I said, thanks, dad. I love you too. See you later. Dad said, hey, where's my kiss? I said, dad, not here. You know, my friends, you know, honestly, give that a rest. Dad's like, all right, I get it. Go. So anyway, I get out and I hand my bags to the bus driver, get on the bus. Full bus, fixing to leave. I look up and to my horror, my father had got on the bus. This is June. It's the summertime. He's wearing shorts. He pulled his shorts up to here. Socks up to there. And he got on the bus with a limp. And he grabbed the mic of the bus and he said, excuse me, everybody. This bus isn't leaving until my Shaney Wayne, he comes up here and gives me a kiss. The whole bus starts screaming, kiss him, kiss him. Your dad had issues. Of course your dad had issues. Everybody's dad has issues. The question isn't whose family had issues and whose dad was issue-free. The question is are you predetermined to repeat those issues, or can you make a better choice by taking responsibility and empowering your own life? Which leads me to an observation about common sense. Every person in this room, what you think is normal was formed by your childhood. Your default button for what normal is was formed by childhood, and it's not your fault. What you think is normal is not your fault. It's your parents' fault. What you do with what you think is normal is your responsibility. And sometimes common sense is a good thing. We bathe every day. It's pretty good. We wash our dishes after we eat. Awesome. Sometimes common sense is destructive. We yell and scream and manipulate to get our way. I know that's what you learned, but that's destructive. It's the weekend. Everybody gets wasted. Okay? True, but destructive. Sometimes common sense enhances your life. Sometimes common sense loses the plot. And wisdom is to be able to say, you know what? I know I learned this from my family, but the more I grow up, the more I realize what works and what doesn't work, and I'm going to make a better choice to perpetuate the things that are godly in my family line, and I'm going to eradicate the ungodliness in my family line, because the way I live matters, and I don't want my children to have to undo the same things I have to do. I may as well be the hero of my family tree and change my family tree forever by making better choices. Watch his observation about this. This is Ezekiel. This is so empowering and encouraging. Next slide. For every living soul belongs to me. In other words, any discussion about who belongs to God and who doesn't, ridiculous. If someone's breathing air, they belong to God. They're living in God's world, held together by God's name, breathing God's air. God is for... See, in Ezekiel's world, watch this. In Ezekiel's world, they thought that God was for certain people and against others. We would never think that because we're way past that. And we have a revelation of the risen Christ now that Christ is for the whole world. But in their world, they thought God was for certain people and against others. So if your life was going into disarray, God must be against you. And if your life's going pretty good, then God must be for you. Ezekiel's saying, no. Every living soul belongs to God. The Father as well as the Son. Both alike belong to me. But the soul that sins is the one that's dying. In other words, the generation that is choosing to live outside of God's ways and that sends their life to disrepair, that's their choice. That's not God being for or against anybody. That's their choice. Now you got to understand what he's attacking here. In Ezekiel's world, they thought God was for people and not for others. They also thought that if your father was wicked, that you automatically had to pay for his sins. They believed that is common sense. That if your father did wickedness, that wickedness would then pass on to generations after generations, generation. And the problem with that is that in that belief system, people thought that they were still paying for their sins of people who'd been dead for 100 years. And that is hopelessness. Ezekiel goes, no. Every generation stands on their own two feet before God, and they can make their own choice. Jesus reiterates this later by saying, call no man father except God. In other words, your future is not determined by how righteous or unrighteous your father was. Your future is determined by the choices you are empowered to make. And here's what he does. He takes about 20 verses and he makes this compelling case. I'll summarize it and then I'll read the end. Here's what he says. Suppose a righteous man has a son who turns out is wicked. And then that wicked man has a son who turns out is righteous. Does the righteous guy pay for the sins of the wicked father? Surely not, even though that's what you've been taught your whole life. Surely not. And does the wicked father inherit the righteousness of the righteous son? No. Every generation stands on their own two feet before God, and they make their own choice. Very empowering. In that day, revolutionary. Unreal how cool that was. And here was the conclusion of the matter. This is skipping forward to like verse 18, if you could bring, here we go. He will not die for his father's sin. He'll live. But his father will die for his own sin because he practiced extortion, robbed his brother, and did what was wrong amongst his people. Keep going. Yet you ask, why does the son not share the guilt of the father? In other words, I've been taught my whole life that the son shares the guilt of the father. You're saying that's not true, right? Since the son has done what is just and right and been careful to keep my decrees, he'll live and not die. The soul that sins is the one that will die. Once again, metaphorical, life goes into disrepair. The son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against him. This is so empowering for parents whose children have went off the rails, and they're like, oh, am I responsible for that? No! They're adults! No! And this is also empowering for a child who looks back and says, my dad was a horrible human being. Okay, I'm sorry, but you now have an opportunity to make a better choice, right? But if, now watch this, if a wicked man turns away from his sins he's committed and keeps my decrees and does what is just and right, he'll live and not die. I love that. In other words, no matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get, you're one decision away from turning around and starting back towards life, light, and increase. Doesn't matter. Turn around. Let me state it non-theologically. If the choices you're making aren't working, do something different. Turn around. At least try something different. Give something else a go. That road goes off that cliff every time. Turn around. If you're going the wrong direction, turn around. The intention of your heart never determines where you go in life. It's always the road that you're on. If you're on the M1 going south, thinking you're heading to the Sunshine Coast, Coffs Harbor is going to be remarkably small compared to what you were imagining. If you're on the road to death, darkness, and decrease, turn around. Doesn't matter how far you get down that road. Turn around. There's life on the other side. None of the offenses he's committed will be remembered against him. Because of the righteous things he's done, he'll live. In other words, a new reputation is available. Do I take pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the sovereign Lord? Now, that was huge. In other words, in their mind, they thought God loved to see sinful people destroyed. They loved it. We would never think that because we're more evolved. Like, we would never see a Christian talk on Facebook about God's will to destroy somebody who's living sinfully. You would never hear that now. But back then, that's what they would think. That God would be like, oh, watch this, watch this. This guy's going to destroy his life. Ezekiel's like, no, God's not like that. God is a God that if you're on the wrong road, he puts, hey, get off this road. This road doesn't, oh, come on, man, get off this road. Get off this road. I am pleased when someone turns around and lives. Watch this. Next. But if a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits sin and does the detestable things the wicked man does, will he live? No, none of the righteous things he's done will be remembered. Because of his unfaithfulness, he's guilty of, and because of the sins he's committed, he'll die. Now watch this. In other words, no matter how far down the road of death, darkness, and decrease you get, turn around. But no matter how far down the road of life, light, and increase you get, good decisions do not work like a savings account. It's not like you can make 20 years of good decisions, and then because you've made 20 years of good decisions, you get 20 years of awful decisions before you get back to zero. I wish it worked like that, but it doesn't. Whoever has the best marriage in the room, I'm happy for you, but your marriage is one really bad decision away from getting wobbly. Like whoever's got the best business in the room, I'm happy for you, but your business is one not very well thought out decision from going wobbly. Essentially, let me state it very simply. If you're on the road to death, darkness, and decrease, Ezekiel's saying, turn around. Try something different. But if you're on the road to life, light, and increase, keep going every single day. Keep responding. This is not something you make a decision once and it just works. You keep going every single day. Yet you say, watch this, of course he had people come against him. Yet you say the way of the Lord is not just. In other words, there were people going, this isn't what we were taught our whole life. No way. This isn't just. What we've been taught is better. And Ezekiel's like, wait a minute. You were taught your whole life that there are people paying for the sins of someone who's been dead 100 years. That doesn't sound fair at all. Watch what he says. Is my way unjust? Is it not your ways that are unjust? If a righteous man turns from his righteousness to commit sin, he'll die. Because of the sins he's committed, he'll die. But if a wicked man turns away from the wickedness he's committed and does what is right, he'll save his life. In other words, if you're going this way and turn around, you'll save your life. If you're going this way and turn back around, you can ruin your life. You keep going. Because he's considered all the offenses he's committed and turns away from them, he'll live and not die. Yet the house of Israel says the way of the Lord is not just. In other words, Ezekiel's going, think about what you've been taught. That's not fair. This is fair. Every generation stands on their own two feet before God, and you make the right choice. Empower your life. Are my ways unjust? Is it not your ways that are unjust? Therefore, O house of Israel, I'll judge you each according to his own ways, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent. That just means turn around. Turn away from your offenses so that sin will not be your downfall. Rid yourselves of the offenses you've committed. In other words, get rid of the behavior that doesn't promote life, light, and increase. And get a new heart and a new spirit. I'm going to read that again slowly. Rid yourself of all the offenses you've committed and get a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, O house of Israel? For I take no pleasure in the death of anyone, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent and live. Now, you might be thinking, Shane, first, decent sermon. Second, hilarious. But what do we do with all this? Okay, couple things. Next slide. First, we have to own the fact that all of us are shaped by our history and heritage. Okay? Let me speak something into every adult in the room. Okay? What you think is normal is not your fault. Some people grow up in families where promiscuity is normal. Some people grow up in families where purity is honored. Some people grow up in families that authentically and calmly talk things out. Some people grow up in families and they raise Cain every time. Some people grow up in families where everybody was selfless and trying to make sure everybody else was happy. Some people grow up in families where there's no end to the manipulation someone will do to get their own way. And what you think is normal, what I think is normal, the default button comes from that. And we need to call that what it is. It is there. But second, number two, we need to repent and live. Take responsibility and live. Now I want to stop and pause and I want to speak very slowly at this point. Because I want to speak life into some people in the room that I feel a heavy heart for, and I want to help you. And if you'll give me a few minutes here, I promise you this will help. As I was speaking and telling jokes, maybe you were thinking this. Shane, funny. Second, your dad was a good man who did things that at 41 you can now laugh about. I wish my father would have got on the bus and wanted me to kiss him. I wish my dad would have scared me underneath the bed. Because if you knew what my dad put me through, that stuff is funny, and it's funny for a reason, because it's funny. But what my dad did to me, not funny. And it's not okay. And on a day like today, I find it hard because I know every church in the world is going to be like, okay, honor your father, that your day will be long in the land. And my dad was an idiot. My dad was a horrible human being. My dad was a mongrel. My dad did things to us that should remain unspoken. My dad was absent. My dad was a drunk. My dad called me names. My dad did things that no father should do. How on earth am I ever meant to honor someone who is that bad? Two thoughts. Three. One, I'm very sorry for what happened. There's no excuse for a helpless person to be exposed to such nonsense. A kid doesn't have a place in his brain or her brain to cope with that. And I'm so sorry. Second, you don't honor someone because they're honorable. You honor someone because you are. That's two. But third and most important, in Hebrew, the word honor has nothing to do with what you do towards someone. and everything to do with how you behave away from someone. Let me explain what I mean. If you're a father of a teenager and they said, "Dad, I honor you," well, that would bless your heart. But what would bless your heart more is to know that at 11 o'clock at South Bank, when they're with their friends, they're acting in an honorable way that honors your name there when you're not around. That's actually what honor is. To say to your pastor, "Pastor, I honor you, 30 years of service. Wow, man, giving it a go for God with that kind of consistency. Man, I honor you." And you should say that, and that would bless his heart. But what would bless his heart more is to know that when you're at the Hyperdome or when you're in downtown Brisbane, when he's not around, that you're acting in such a way that honors Impact Church's values there, not here. So how do you honor a father who's useless? Ready? You make a choice to perpetuate to the next generation the parts of him that are honorable. And surely there's a little bit of good in there somewhere. But even if not, you choose to eradicate the writ, you rid yourself of that behavior so that the next generation will never ever see it. And here's what happens. You become the hero of your family tree. Let me explain what I mean. About 3 times a year, I'll get asked this. "Shane, wow, you must come from a long line of preachers." No. My great-grandfather couldn't read, write. He was an illiterate moonshiner. If you don't know what that is, he made his money by running illegal alcohol across state lines. He was an illiterate moonshiner, member of the Ku Klux Klan, racist. That was my great-grandfather. Illiterate, moonshining, racist member of the Ku Klux Klan. And you might think, wait a minute, how do you get from that to what I'm seeing on this stage right now? Here's how. My mom and dad stood on their own 2 feet before God, and they said, "No, no, no. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Our children will learn to read. Our children will go to school. Our children will learn God. Our children will learn worship. Our children will learn the presence of Jesus. And our children will not be racist because that's stupid." And in one generation of making that choice, me and my brother are both master's degree educated. Neither one of us are racist. Neither one of us were very highly literate. We're highly successful within reason. So we went from a literate moonshining racist to a guy that's given his whole life to traveling the world telling people about Jesus in one move. That's honor. What better way to honor my great-grandfather than to have people wondering if he was a preacher when he was a moonshiner? That's honor. The best way for you to honor your father is to perpetuate godliness away from him. And people will wonder. They'll say, "Man, you must have had a good dad." Actually, no. He was a plonker, a useless, abusive drunk. But I made a better choice. That will save your life. And here's the truth. The only hope for you to live the best possible life is for you to honor your father. How do you honor him? You rid yourself of all that negative behavior and you get a new heart and a new spirit. Here's what Ezekiel says, last slide. He says, when we choose to live God's ways, God gives us a new heart and a new spirit. And here's the thing. There's a way to teach this that sounds like this. You need to come up here today and you need to get healed so that you can act better. People say to me all the time, "Oh, Shane, if my heart could just get healed, I could behave better. Oh, if my heart could just get healed, I could behave better." It's so disempowering. And that's Ezekiel's point. Listen to me. Some things you can't be healed from. Some violations are so personal. Healed from that? I don't think so. Some divorces are so healed from that? And that's the beauty of Ezekiel's point. Ezekiel's point is, God is not interested in healing your wounded heart. God is interested in giving you a brand spanking new one. Why would you walk around with a mended up wounded heart when God is holding a heart transplant? And here's what Ezekiel says. If by faith you begin to act within God's ways, a new heart and a new spirit is built into the reinforcement of that. And that's the single most empowering thing you could possibly say to a group of slaves who are there because their father ate sour grapes. Now, I want us to take a second. I want us to cancel the white noise of our week. And I want you to be brave enough underneath your breath to pray this prayer. Lord Jesus, if you're sitting next to your spouse, if you could just take them by the hand, unless you're particularly angry at them, don't worry about it, just touch their leg or something. And I want you to ask this now, and I want you to commit to asking this later. Is there anything that we are putting up with in our family habits that actually isn't good? It's just because that's how we were raised. Let me ask it another way. Holy Spirit, is there anything that we are rationalizing now that we'll regret later? And make a commitment to shift it. While you're doing business with God, if there's anybody here who's never received Jesus and you'd like to change your family tree today by making that choice, and you can know I'm talking to you if like you can feel God pulling at your heart. If God's not pulling at your heart, don't worry about it. I don't want to manipulate God. I just want to cooperate with what he's doing. And if you need words to say, you can say something like, Lord Jesus, today I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust that your version of my life story is better than the one I've been writing on my own, and I'm going to surrender to that. Would all of you look this way? Thanks so much for letting me be a part of your Father's Day. I hope you were inspired by that. Moved, entertained, challenged. Listen to me. May you be people who choose life, not death. Light, not dark, regardless of what your father did. Listen to me. Today's your day where you can be a hero for your entire family tree. And if you make that choice, you will be. And if you don't, there will be a day that you wish you would. Because if you don't, your children will have to. You be the person. You make that choice. You be the hero of your family tree. Rid yourself of that behavior and get a new heart and a new spirit. And may it never, ever be said about anybody in this place ever again that my father ate sour grapes and it set my teeth on edge. Life is better than that. I bless you to be people who are the hero of your family tree. Happy Father's Day. Grace and peace, everybody. God bless.
Come on, why don't you stand to your feet and give Shane a big hand. Thank you, Shane. Outstanding. Can I have our team come to stage, please?